Thank you.
And I'll just add to that that sometimes people struggle because they think I'm asking you to figure out what I'll say, but it's really okay. I can figure that out usually, unless it's somebody's birthday and you want me to say happy birthday. Just the name would be really helpful, even if it's your own name. And you think I should know it, which is probably true. As I say, sometimes at my age, those neurons are gone. So it's not always that easy, even though I know I will meet many of you again, I hope, in many places. And I will know perfectly who you are, except not your name. So, okay, so we have loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. We have three aspects of an action, of motivation, the skillfulness of execution, and the immediate result. The first three of those qualities, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, as we develop them, we are said to transmute our field of motivation. So that if largely we have been coming, for example, from a place of fear, in what we do or what we say, and we do these practices, we will largely find ourselves coming from a different place of connection, of caring. And it's not studied in the sense that it's not like you're in some situation, you give yourself a lecture, like I don't really feel like smiling or responding kindly, but you know, I spent all weekend. And after all, you know, what if I find, you know, anyone finds out that I really spent all weekend, it was a total waste, so I better act like, you know, it's not like that. It's like that whole arena of where we're coming from, it shifts, it changes, and that's why there's also a kind of naturalness to the expression of loving kindness. We see that in very ordinary and extraordinary beings. You know, you don't, I mean, the Dalai Lama is always my favorite model of this. You don't really get the sense, watching him, that he's meeting somebody and thinking, oh God, you're boring. You know, but I am the Dalai Lama, so everyone expects me to be kind. So, you know, you don't ever get that feeling. It's just something that's flowing. Because of the shifts that, and but to say it's natural doesn't mean it's happenstance. And he's the one who gets up at what, 3 o'clock every morning to do 4 hours of practice. It doesn't just happen, but the manifestation is a manifestation of our inner being. So it's not like you're forcing something or it feels artificial at that time. One of my friends, when the Dalai Lama was given the Nobel Peace Prize, said, giving the Dalai Lama a peace prize is like giving Mother Nature an art award. But it doesn't just happen, really. But still, there's that beautiful quality of feeling. It's not disconnected, you know, the inner state from the outer manifestation. It just kind of flows in that way. So we practice those qualities, we deepen those qualities. We always work with mindfulness. That's how we know what our motivation is. That's how we can be in touch with what we really care about. That's how we can make choices, because we're aware. That's how we look at a context. Mindfulness in a bigger sense, like where am I? Is this the kind of thing maybe best done privately? Or what if I give this gift in front of everybody and I only have one? Or, you know, we can pay attention. Or I said yes the last 50 times I was asked by this person. You know, what does this really feel like inside now? Does this feel like generosity or does this feel like something else? What are the consequences of my actions been? Is this a road I want to keep going down? You know, it's like we use awareness, we use mindfulness to pay attention in all those broader ways as well. And then the last of those 3 of motivation, skillfulness of execution, and immediate response is immediate response. Like, maybe I give you the gift, and I'm really sensitive, and I'm very aware, and I'm coming from a loving place, and how are you responding to me? That's the place where we need the deepening and the development of equanimity, because that's a place for not in control. We can and should be more and more aware of our motives. We can work with coming from a better place. We can learn skills of execution and manifestation, be aware of the context and the environment, the situation we're in. We can here learn new skills as we pay attention. And then the response that happens in that moment is really not in our control. But remember, equanimity doesn't mean indifference, and it doesn't mean a declaration we have nothing to learn. You know, like your blasé attitude is totally your problem. It has nothing to do with the fact that I did this in this way. It's not a kind of harsh judgment like that. We might always look at our level of skillfulness. But the idea that somehow we will do something so perfectly so that inevitably it will dominate someone's reaction, it's just not real. And one of the basic principles of life is realizing that when we're in conflict with reality, we're going to suffer. Right? When we're, it's like banging your head against the wall, it's going to hurt. Because we're just living at some odd angle to how things are instead of in harmony with how things are. So we go back to the understanding of equanimity. In the Buddhist teaching, they talk about 8 vicissitudes or 8 conditions of life. I'm sure many of you are quite familiar with this, that life is pleasure and pain and gain and loss, and praise and blame, and fame and disrepute. It's pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. This is the nature of things. There's no one whose life is just pleasure and no pain. And going back to what we were talking about the other day, praise and blame, there is no one whose life is just praise and not blame. And I often talk about this lovely story from the time of the Buddha where a man came to the Buddha's monastery to learn something of what the Buddha taught. And the first person he came upon was this monk who'd taken a temporary vow of silence. So when he was asked, he didn't say anything. And the man got really furious and he stomped away. So the same man came back a second day and came upon another disciple of the Buddha's who was very famous not only for his great realization, but for his great theoretical knowledge. And so when he was asked, he launched into a very long, elaborate theoretical explanation, and the man got really furious. He stomped away. So the same man came back. On the third day, he came upon another disciple of the Buddha's, this monk named Ananda. And Ananda, having heard what happened on the first day, and what happened on the second day, was careful to say something, but not too much. And the man got really furious. And he said something like, "How dare you treat such profound matters so sketchily?" And he stomped away. So this group of people went off to see the Buddha, and they said, "Oh, Lord Buddha, this is what happened on the first day. This is what happened on the second day. This is what happened on the third day. What do you have to say?" And the Buddha said, "There's always blame in this world. You say nothing, some people will blame you. You say a lot, some people will blame you. You say just a little bit, some people will blame you. There's always blame in this world." And that doesn't mean we don't care. We don't try to improve or learn more skills. Of course we care. But how much do we care? Because there's always praise and blame. Always, always. In the example we've been using, you know, if I reached down and gave somebody a vase of flowers, how could I possibly control everything in their head and in their body as they walk into that room to receive it? it's just not realistic that we will write the perfect book so that no one ever will have a criticism. We will give the perfect gift so that no one ever will have a criticism. And of course we care, but do we need to be defined by what we can't actually control? Or can we have wisdom and balance, which means equanimity, to understand every moment is all these conditions coming together and coming apart? Can we have a measure of peace, even as all of this is happening? And I love Praise and Blame stories, as I said yesterday, because it's the exact same thing that's bringing forth praise from some people and blame from others. It's so interesting. Not too long ago, I was going to this event in Washington, D.C. called Buddha Fest. It's like a Buddhist film festival. And they have talks and all kinds of things, as well as different films. So I was going to speak, actually, with Sokhi Rinpoche on Saturday morning. And I was going down early enough on Friday so that I could hear Tim Ryan speak Friday night. Tim Ryan is a congressman from Ohio. He's a meditator, and he wrote a book called A Mindful Nation. So I wanted to hear him speak. And I ended up, a friend gave me a ride down from where I was, and we arrived early enough so that somebody actually just sent us into the auditorium to sit down before they opened the doors for the event. So I'm sitting next to my friend, and it was kind of like this odd seating thing in that we were in the second row of the auditorium, but there was like a cutout in front of us, so there was no front row. It's like an exit seat in the airplane or something, just for those few seats. So we're sitting there, and they open the doors, and people start coming in. And those of you who have my book, Faith, know that it's a very, or have seen it, it's a very distinctive salmon-colored cover. So as I was sitting there, I saw this woman walking around with the book, which I recognized by the cover. And I said to my friend, oh, look, she's got Faith. And she came over to me, and she sort of knelt down in the cutout and asked me to sign the book, which I was very happy to do. And I signed the book, and she looked at me and she said, you're a goddess, which I liked. And she got up and she went away. And then Tim Ryan's communication director at the time, who was also someone I know, came over to introduce a journalist to me. And I would say the journalist was probably the least interested in meeting me of probably anyone I've met in my life. And she said, this is Sharon Salzberg. And he was like, huh. And she said, have you heard of her work? And he said, no. So my friend next to me whispered, tell him you're a goddess. Okay? And I said, I don't think so. You know, it didn't even take 1 minute sitting there to have these different reactions, right? Life is just like that. And naturally, I like one better than the other. But really, how crazy it is to get defined by all these people's reactions, because they're constantly changing all of the time. So when we look at the result of an action, we take that into account. It's not indifference, it's wisdom. And if we're looking for the source of our integrity in the action, we look back at our motivation. Where was that coming from, truly? And the level of skill. Might I have said that differently? Might I have done that differently? Did I really pay attention to where I was? And then what we need is equanimity, it's balance. To recognize, well, first of all, we don't know everything right now, right? It's the Hindsight Meditation Society. And that there's always blame in this world. That's just how it is. So that's just like one example of taking the truth of all of these states and realizing that they work together. We want to be able, we need to be able to open to suffering. That's compassion. But we also need to be able to open to joy as a balance. We don't want to only be willing to open to joy because that gives us an awfully narrow life. But it's a part of things. That's how we find balance. Compassion and sympathetic joy will balance each other. Equanimity will balance them all. That's what it actually means. So when we say that we are practicing all of them through the vehicle of one of them, that's exactly what we're doing. We're taking, commonly, although it doesn't have to be, the vehicle of loving kindness with those phrases and that sequence, and bringing in all of the other qualities as well. So we have time for a few more questions or comments if you want.
The story.
Which story? Oh, my story. Thank you. How did I go to India? Or why did I go to India? I went to India, didn't I talk about this?
Friday night.
Friday night, okay. I went to India as a junior in college, basically. I'd gone to college when I was 16, which is also a function of the New York City public school system, or at least in those days, I don't know about now, where they skip grades. People can skip grades, so I skipped third grade and eighth grade. And I went to college when I was 16. I took an Asian philosophy course in my sophomore year, and that's where I first heard about Buddhism and meditation. And there was also an independent study program at the university where you could create a project, and if they approved it, you could go anywhere in the world. And theoretically come back for your final year and do a kind of cross-cultural study. And I, you know, I had a really fractured, difficult, painful childhood, and I heard about this prospect of meditation making you a happier person. There was nobody I knew who was actually doing it or teaching it in the States, and so I created an independent study project, and I asked permission to get credit for going to India and studying meditation, and I got it. So I went. And I ended up staying somewhat more than a year. I came back, I was going to school in Buffalo, New York. I went back to Buffalo. I did what I needed to do, which was largely paperwork and writing some, I don't know where it is now, it would be really interesting to find. I wrote some humongous paper on Buddhism. Got 2 years of independent study credit in the end, and went back to India. Until 1974.
Thank you.
So I have a follow-up on that.
The microphone's very close.
It's on, okay. You were so young to be starting a meditation institute, and in hindsight, looking back on that now, you know, I guess I, you know, from my point of view, seeing a couple of 23-year-olds or something starting a meditation center, I probably wouldn't go there, you know, looking for a teacher. So in hindsight, you know, that's pretty amazing. And what do you think about it?
I think I was pretty young. Well, there are kind of two aspects to that. I mean, Joseph and Jack were somewhat older, but not, you know, they were both under 30. One aspect is the organizational aspect of it, which I knew nothing about, and I dare say none of us did, but we were very fortunate, and then we had like an actual board of directors, you know, with lawyers and people who knew things, and it was all very odd and new, and we were really I mean, we get the credit in a lot of ways publicly, but it was really the people on the board of directors and on the staff who saved us, because they knew what a mortgage was. And you know, people used to say things to us like, well, you know, you have to budget for depreciation or you have to budget for emergency repairs. Like, what if the roof leaks? And it was like, really? Well, we'll just ask people for money then. And they said, no, you don't do that. Like, you know, so we really, organizationally, we had an enormous amount of help. And in terms of teaching, yes, I was much younger than almost anybody that was coming to learn. And, I mean, it was in some ways a problem for me in my own anxiety or, you know, wondering about what I was doing. But there weren't a whole lot of other places to go, you know, and so I had been helped so hugely by those tools, and I felt, I clearly had the blessing and encouragement of my teachers, and I felt it was imperative that I'd be able to offer them, because I had gotten so much help from them, and we just did the best we could. I mean, you know, it's hard to even describe what a different world this is now. When people say, oh, we have, you know, three mindfulness teachers in this institution and in the hospital and five in the schools, and you think, oh my God, you know. It's a very different world.
Okay. Over here.
Keep waiting until my glasses are off. Yes, thank you.
So when I practice mindfulness of breathing, I not always, but often enough, I kind of just get this feeling of anxiety when I focus on the breath, and when I become aware of the breath, and kind of the more I watch the breath, the more anxious I become. Could you say something about that?
Sometimes that happens, and it's not like weird or, you know, totally unknown by any means. Sometimes it's eased by having that experience is eased by having a kind of broader and more expansive, what we call primary object, you know, that home base for awareness. So there are a number of ways of doing that. One is you might, I don't know if you do, but you might try sitting with your eyes open. That might help. Start by listening to sound, which also provides a more expansive sense of things. Feel your body within the awareness of that space, and then feel the breath within that. So instead of it being a more kind of confined or narrow perspective, you know, that might ease things. And for some people, for all kinds of reasons, the breath is not the most suitable primary object. And so in Burma, for example, they might suggest a little bit of a variation on what I just described, where you start out, whether your eyes are open or closed, noticing what you see in your visual field, and you quietly make a mental note of seeing, and then you notice what you're hearing. So it's hearing, and then sitting, your feet just flash on your whole posture, and then touching, you bring your attention to a touch point, someplace, you know, maybe like your hands touching your knees, some area around the size of a quarter. And that substitutes for the breath. It's seeing, hearing, sitting, touching, or it might be loving. You know, there's just so many possibilities that it's not right or wrong or superior or inferior. The breath is commonly chosen as that primary object because it is so portable, but so is listening to sound or feeling your body. And so it can serve. You know, absolutely. Some other object can serve. And also, this won't last forever. So, you know, this is something you might bring back as an experiment, you know, at different times and just see how it feels.
I wonder if you might have a suggestion regarding delusion. I am predominantly delusional type, and I wonder, especially in this landscape of action, motivation, loving kindness practice, Confucianism, but even in action and decision, is so predominant Confucian and it's so hard for me. So I was wondering if you have some simple advice.
Okay, so the question was about, it referred to actually also from the Buddhist psychology in the Theravada tradition, in the Burmese Thai tradition, as distinct from the Tibetan tradition, which has a different model, but kind of similar too. In the Burmese tradition, there are descriptions of certain personality types. And they're not exclusive. You know, we all have all three tendencies, which make up the distinct personality types, for sure. And they exist in, you could say, an unpurified form and a purified form. So the names are a little nasty, but that doesn't mean that they're bad states or that they remain like that. And sometimes someone, just how we are, means that we don't necessarily have all three in equal measure all the time. We might predominate in one. Okay, so the three types are the greedy type, the angry type, and the deluded type. And they each have purified forms. And certainly we all have greed, anger, greed, hatred, and delusion. But sometimes we're just put together in such a way that one is really very predominant. So the greedy type doesn't mean you're a greedy person at all. It means that there are certain tendencies that will likely be strong. So, for example, walking into a room and noticing what you like, even to the point of overlooking what's wrong. Like, wow, I really like this rug. You know, maybe there's like a gaping hole over there on the stage, which is not, but let's say. And I don't even notice that, because I'm just like, wow, that would fit really well in my new living room, I think. Or maybe I could knock down a wall, you know, just so I could have it, right? So it's like our eye, our perception tends to go toward what we like, sometimes to the exclusion of what's not really working, what's not really right. So I sometimes say that's the kind of person who, in a meeting, you present a dilemma or a problem, and they'll say, it'll all work out. And you think, how? Because there's such a strong disinclination to go to what's troublesome, what's painful or difficult. And the aversive type, or the angry type, the second type, is the opposite of that. It's the kind of person who will walk into a room and notice what they don't like, and overlook sometimes what's really wonderful and beautiful. It's just where they go, you know, like, huh, look, petals are falling off the flowers. You think they'd last longer. Really? You know, and not notice the beautiful cloth or the beautiful flowers or anything. You know, it's just like, huh, could be better. So I sometimes describe that as a person in a meeting where some wonderful opportunity is presented and they say, it's not going to work. And you think, well, why not? And then there's the deluded type, which I am very strongly, and so I do get asked about delusion a lot. In this context, delusion doesn't necessarily mean ignorance. It means kind of a cloud, like being spacey, or Not really knowing what you feel sometimes. Being out of touch. It correlates so much what I was talking about, pleasure, pain, and neutrality, grasping, aversion, and delusion, like numbness or being kind of foggy, being out of touch. So deluded type is the kind of person who would tend to walk into a room and not notice much of anything until someone says, look at that rug, and you think, yeah, a rug, it's great, I need one. And, you know, in a meeting, they might be quite swayed at first, not forever, but at first, by how someone else is presenting something, because they just kind of enter that world. So the usual story I tell about delusion is some years ago, I have a house right next door to the, well, not quite right next door, it's like through the forest, a little distance, to the retreat center in Barrie. And one day, years ago, I drove to Cambridge to give a talk, and I drove back late at night, and I just parked outside my house. And the next morning, I got up to walk over to the retreat center through the forest to teach, because there was a course going on. And I walked right by the place I left my car, and it was gone. So I went through the woods, and I went into the staff dining room at the center, and I said, there was a person hanging out in the staff dining room who, if anybody had taken the car, like to put gas in it or something, it would have been him. So I said, have you seen my car? And he said, no. And I said, really? It's gone. And he said, it's gone? And I said, yeah. And then came the killer moment. He said, are you sure it's gone? And I thought, am I sure it's gone? I just walked right by him. I mean, car's a big thing. Did I miss it? I mean, that's the delusion. And I said, I think it's gone. And then one of my colleagues walked into the staff dining room, who's self-admittedly angry type. And I said to her, have you seen my car? And she said, you can't find your car? And I said, no. And she said, well, you know, you just lent it to somebody and you forgot who it was. Which is actually a very good invitation for her. You know, you just lent it to somebody, forgot who it was you lent it to. And then I thought, who did I lend my car to? So then I went upstairs to work, to teach, because we see people in groups or individual interviews, meetings, to talk about meditation, their meditation practice. So every once in a while, through the morning, I think, who did I lend my car to? Do that. So I went down at lunchtime, and I saw someone else, and I said, have you seen my car? And someone overheard me and said, oh, I know what happened to your car. I said, what happened to my car? And they said, well, someone had this emergency, and they needed a car, and, you know, it was somehow the only car that they could take, so I told them they could just take it. And then they said, I didn't think you'd notice. You know, that's a deluded type. Although these aren't permanent fix things either. A lot of my friends are maintaining I'm no longer deluded, but I think I am. And like I said, we're all everything anyway, but sometimes you really can't see that there's such a strong tendency one way or another. It's kind of interesting. And like all these systems, it can be useful because it depersonalizes it. It's realizing, oh, that's my conditioning, that's my personality type. I will tend toward this. So maybe I have to try to bring that into balance. Mindfulness itself is said to be a great balancing agent for all of these. And especially in terms of delusion, it's contact. It's being connected, being aware. Wise attention. You know, making a point of noticing, because there are good parts to each of these, and that's the purified form. The greed becomes what's called faith, which doesn't mean doctrinal faith. It means like a love of life. That positive orientation becomes a love of life. And this willingness to be close to experience. And aversion or anger actually becomes a kind of wisdom, because their anger is a very complex state, and the positive part of it is like this cutting through energy. Like, maybe it's the angry person in the room who's the only person willing to say, hey, there's a gaping hole in the stage, right? So it's cutting through social niceties and efforts at denial and all those other things. There are a lot of other qualities to anger, like the burning and the narrowness and the fixation, that are a big, big problem. But the purified form is just that kind of cutting through. Like, oh, here it is. Let's look at the hole in the stage. Right? And the purified form of delusion is a kind of equanimity. It's balance. In the midst of the delusion, it's balance because you're not noticing anything. Like, I also tell the story sometimes about traveling. The one time I went to Tibet, it was in 1985. I was on my way to Burma. And my friend and I went to China, and through China and then overland to Tibet and Kathmandu. And she was a self-diagnosed greedy type, right? So we would check into some hotel in China or somewhere, and she would say, do you mind if I take that bed over there? And I'd say no. And then like 15 minutes later, I'd say, why don't you want that bed? And she would say, well, the mosquito net doesn't have a hole in it, and it's right near the light, so I can control the light, it's right near the window, so I can control the window, and, you know, the mattress isn't sagging. And she just listed all these attributes where I'd noticed nothing. So we, from then on, we're always saying, deluded types are very good to travel with. You know, they're very mellow about everything, but that's because we don't notice much. So the antidote is noticing. It's very immediate attention, making contact with the present moment's experience, being aware. And the purified form of that will be still a lot of equanimity, but with the kind of precision of the noticing, of the awareness. And that's how we work with it. Okay, so I want to say 1 minute's worth of stuff about daily practice. Many of you may already have a regular practice. If you don't, I really urge you to have one. It's quite hard for us, I noticed, through these years, to actually take something we admire in the abstract and make it real. And, you know, there's all kinds of reasons for that in terms of our conditioning, but it's the really important thing to just actually practice. And when I went to India that time, the first time in 18, I could readily have said, and probably did say, well, I understand everything about Buddhism. I took a course. You know, I had midterms. I wrote papers. But when I sat down to meditate, and it was my knee pain, and it was my anxiety, it was different. So one teacher of mine said, the most important moment of your entire practice is the moment you sit down to do it. And after that, it'll feel different ways. Some days it'll feel great, some days it'll feel not so great. Over time, it will definitely make a difference in our lives. But you got to do it. That difference doesn't come about from thinking, that's a great idea. Which I consider too bad, because it would be so much easier. I've asked several neuroscientist friends of mine, because as I put it here the other day, as I tend to put it, it is America. Everybody wants to know what's the least amount of time I can put into this thing and really change my brain. And I've had different answers at different times, but the answers have ranged from 20 minutes a day to half an hour a day. Right? Nobody thus far has said you've got to do this a minimum of 4 hours a day to have a real result. So there's something about the everydayness of it, and obviously you don't want to necessarily do the bare minimum. But there does seem to be something enormous that happens because of the regularity of making it real. I've often encouraged people to try to sit for 20 minutes a day. If you can do longer, definitely do longer. If you can't sit, maybe it's walking. It's that period of dedication where you're not saying, well, I'm going to mindfully and, you know, but it's just like, okay, I'm just going to work with being aware or doing loving kindness. And as I said yesterday, you know, I've spent years just doing loving kindness practice. That's a choice. Many people I know do some awareness practice and some kind of compassion practice. That's a choice. Or these days, I really do mostly my loving kindness practice, as I said, you know, walking around the streets of New York and more informal times like that, whereas my sitting, which is each day, is more mindfulness practice. There's so many options. It's really up to you, but it's that dedication. It's like alchemy. It's taking something abstract and saying, I'm going to make it real. And it seems very, very important. I just keep getting struck by both how hard it is to find 20 minutes a day or half an hour a day, and how it's really not a huge amount. And so there are so many things that people find are supportive of that ability to actually do it. It could be a community, it could be a group, and you know, this is a fabulous place. There's Chergar, there's Common Ground, there's so many instances of people coming together, being supportive. Study is often a really big help. It's understanding, because then that wisdom is reinforced of what we can expect, what we really would be unfair to expect, unfair toward ourselves to expect from a practice. And it's really fabulous to connect to something bigger, you know, a sense of a bigger picture of practice in so many ways. And there are lots of things that you can explore to see what will help you. People often ask, should I sit in the morning or should I sit in the evening? Should I sit at the same time every day? Should I sit in the same place every day? And I always say it depends on what works for you, because that's the right time to do it, because you're actually going to do it. And so see if you can actually bring this into your life or reinforce its place in your life if you've had a practice all this while. And I want to thank you. And we're going to do 2 minutes of sharing merit practice, maybe four, and then Edwin is going to take over. So this is what I said is sort of that almost ritualistic way of ending. It's a form of loving kindness practice. And it begins with sensing the joy or the positive energy from having been here. There are lots of ways of spending a weekend. You made a choice. This isn't really like congratulating yourself in a weird way, but it's understanding that power of goodness, that you made this choice. You thought about things, and you practiced, and you asked questions, or you reflected. No matter what the quality of your concentration felt like, is the fact that you came that is the generator of the merit of that positive force. And with whatever words make sense to you, in your own words, we dedicate, we share, we offer this energy. Something like, may the merit of my practice be shared with you. May you be safe. May you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. Beginning with those who've helped you. and those whom you know are hurting or having difficulty, in an affirmation of the fact that our practice could never be just for ourselves alone. And then one another. And all beings everywhere. So thank you.
This is great.
So first of all, I would like to thank you all, each and every one of you, for coming here this weekend and sharing your time with us. I hope you feel like you've benefited from this as much as I have. But an event of this nature would not be possible without a lot of hard work and dedication from many people. Turga was very fortunate to have some partners reach out here and support and offer the opportunity to work with many folks and people. First of all, I'd very much like to thank Common Ground. In addition to that, I very much like to say that the spiritual family is healing from you, Pastor Dawson and all the people that work with her, and all that they do in this community to bring the practices and make the practices available in situations where they might not always find their way. It was interesting. Sharon mentioned that if this is the first time you've been to a program that introduces you to meditation, there are some very rich offerings in this town. And the Center for Spirituality Healing, the mindfulness-based stress reduction programs that they do are really, really valuable programs. So I would encourage you to start there if you feel inclined. Common Ground Meditation Center has a wonderful staff of meditation instructors and so forth, and I think you'll find a home there very easily. And then, of course, there's Togar. Like our meditation community and all the programs that we have to offer for people who don't regard themselves to be Buddhists or for people who really want to become Buddhists. We also offer programs, trainings, both meditation and study. And we also have a very vibrant offering online to guide audio, video, written material, and we also offer courses, the Joy of Living programs online too, at very reasonable price if you wish to sign up and participate in those programs. So I do particularly want to thank my staff in Turga. Judith Fabia, is Judith in the room? Judith is not in the room. Judith's one of these people that you'll never see. But I can assure you, you may notice her, but I can assure you an event like this would not run as smoothly and as well without the diligent work of Judith. So I would really love to thank Judith. I hope you're hearing this, Judith. And then Pamela Reimer in our bookstore and all the great work that she does. And I know that there was a large number of people who volunteered and helped. I can't name them all because I fear I'd leave somebody out. But a lot of people came together to help make this program happen here and run so smoothly over the last few days, over the last couple of days. So thank you all. But then, of course, obviously, I need to thank Sharon Salzberg. It's been a pure delight, Sharon. Thank you. It's interesting, you know, our connection goes way back in many kind of ways. And even I feel like I've learned over the years that there were connections that you were connected to that I was connected to before we ever met, which is really kind of a remarkable teaching in and of itself. But I've been particularly struck by two things this weekend having you here. First of all, how clearly you demonstrate the fruits of your own practice in the way you just skillfully talk about what it's like to meditate. It's very obvious you've sat down and you've taken a good, long, hard look at yourself. And the candidness with which you're able to share, the willingness that you're able to share that with us is really, really... and the humour with which you do that, I think, is really great. And the second thing that really struck me is that the wisdom that comes through from 40 years of teaching this to other people and just how skillful you and ability you have to be able to share your wisdom with people so that they can see, they empathise, they you know, you normalise what goes on in our minds so that we all can relate to it in a way that I think is very skillful. So from the bottom of my heart, on behalf of Toto, I would like to thank you so much for coming here, and I do hope you return soon. Thank you very much.